So we are moving around the mandala and finding ways of supporting spiritual receptivity, supporting just sitting with firstly integration, and then yesterday positive emotion. And hopefully this will be a cumulative process, that we won't leave behind the relaxed awareness and the groundedness on day one and feel like, okay, we've been to the heart, done that on day two. We'll bring all that with us. Yeah. So, and we can bring with us any of the methods that we've been using, like Falun. We can certainly bring with us this whole thing of turning towards our experience in a very open-hearted way. And we can also bring with us a connection with our heart wish, with what's really important to us, with what we really care about, so that's what's driving us while we're here. If we can touch into that, then our practice will have real power and strength to it. So we've been finding these different ways into just sitting. And you can sort of make a distinction between what you could call pure just sitting, which is really choiceless awareness, where you're just open to your experience as it is. You're not modifying it, you're not doing anything to it. All you're doing is not clinging to it or being averse to it or misinterpreting it. So that's pure just sitting, and that's what Bhante is talking about in that extract from the Rajumpa seminar. But then you can do, I don't know what you call it, sort of partial just sitting, impure just sitting, supported just sitting, where you give yourself some help. Yes, you are opening out into the different senses and your wider experience, but you're doing something like, say, Falun, where you're just keeping a bit of an anchor just to help your mind to stay focused, for instance. Or you take off into just sitting via metta bhavana, as we did yesterday. So a lot of the time it's going to be useful to use these methods in order to help us to enter that space of what we'll call pure just sitting. So today we're coming on round to this wall over here and to spiritual death. Vijayamala and I run these little retreats in Cambridge, and we had one last year which was all about insight. So we called it a spiritual death retreat. And at the end we decided never again. We would never again call a retreat spiritual death, because some of the people who turned up, rather than being in that kind of relaxed, open sort of state which we were trying to encourage, sort of, although they knew it wasn't like this intellectually, just coming on something which had the word death in it made them sort of close in. It sort of made them slightly kind of cringe. And so we had to spend some time, you know, sort of unpacking and sort of releasing that before we could really go deeper into the retreat. So when Bhante's talking about spiritual death, I mean, it's great because it stresses the really sort of radical nature of the transformation that happens. But for a lot of us, we just have to be aware that death, even though we know intellectually it's spiritual death, can bring up sort of resistance and difficulties. And I'm mainly going to talk in terms of insight and wisdom, partly because it's just shorter. So, how does insight support just sitting? How does it support this spiritual receptivity? Because we're not just practicing on our cushion, we're aiming to, everything we're doing here, we're aiming to be able to do all the time. It's, you know, you can walk around practicing relaxed awareness, you can walk around practicing Balu, you can walk around practicing open-hearted metaphor awareness of everything that's going on, external and internal. So when we're in here, we're just giving ourselves a training for what we keep on doing as soon as we get out there. It's not like we suddenly turn off and do something else. It just carries on and carries on. So the whole sort of wisdom aspect takes us from wrong view to right view to perfect vision. And wrong view reinforces the mind's delusions about things, and it brings about a contracted functioning of awareness. If you've been doing that practice where you notice through the day, you know, how much your mind and body is kind of open and expansive and how much is kind of closing down and tightening around something, when there's that closing down and tightening around, there's always some kind of story, there's always some kind of conceptual superstructure that you've built on top of your experience. So right view is at least a much better story and a much simpler and more effective set of concepts to apply to your experience, and that enables us to open much more. It enables us to be much more available to life, much more open to our experience. So if I have the view that my needs are paramount and that everyone is out to get me, then from that point of view, it's actually quite hard to be open and expansive. I'm basically very closed down. Whereas if I have a view that all beings have the potential to gain enlightenment and that loving kindness is a really wonderful way to function, then it's much easier to open and be relaxed. So right view enables us to experience much more fully, our minds to, our awareness to be much more open and relaxed. And insight, direct knowing of how things are, makes it much easier still. It makes it much easier, in fact it eventually makes it natural for our mind to function in a relaxed, aware, simple, open, natural way. So today we're looking at this whole area of views of insight to see how we can learn to function in a way which allows our mind to be open and receptive to experience. So where should we start? Let's start in Pakistan. I read a story once about a British journalist, it might have been James Cameron, who covered a lot of sort of major conflicts and big international stories. And a good number of years ago, he was travelling in Pakistan, and it may have been at the time when Pakistan and India were in conflict. So he was in an army jeep with an army major and their army driver. And they were going somewhere into quite out of the way places, perhaps towards the front line, I don't know, in this jeep. So they'd been travelling for a long time, but it was the middle of the day, the weather was good, they were just going down this sort of single lane road, which didn't really have room to pass, but you could just pull over onto the side of the road if you needed to. And it was a very straight road, quite flat, you could see for maybe a couple of miles, who knows. And at a certain point, as they were driving along and Cameron was talking to the major about the situation, on the horizon appeared a truck, a lorry. So they carried on driving, time passed. The truck came closer, the jeep kept going. Beautiful day, sun shining. Cameron's talking to the major. Truck's getting closer. Jeep's still going. Still a beautiful day. And I don't know that Cameron's even aware of the truck particularly, because they're talking now about, you know, strategy and troop movements and things, and the major's perhaps letting on a certain amount, but not very much, to this British journalist. And now the truck's really quite close, and it's still coming, and the jeep's still going. But, you know, it's obvious there's the jeep, and there's the truck. So, it's all right. Sun's still shining. And now, they're really close. Really close. And there's the sound of the air brakes on the lorry, and the army driver tries to swerve off the road, but it's too late. And they go into one another, and the jeep driver is killed. Now, it was a clear road. It was this beautiful sunny day. They could see one another for miles. The driver was quite awake. The truck driver was quite awake. What was it that killed the jeep driver? Well, you can say it was a lorry. Yeah, okay, I'll accept that. I won't argue with that. But why did it happen? What happened? What killed the jeep driver was concepts. What killed the jeep driver was the story that he was telling himself and the story that the lorry driver was telling himself. Absolutely no other reason. And the stories were: the truck driver thought, I am driving a truck. Yeah. This thing weighs 10 tons or whatever it does. And it's really solid and big, and I am king of the road, and other people ought to get out the way. The jeep driver thought, I am driving an army jeep with an army major sitting in the back. As a military vehicle, I have priority over everything else on the road. And the inevitable consequence of that was that despite the fact that they could see one another quite clearly, still, and actually if you think about your life, you know, there have been various kind of collisions, you know, that have happened in your life, all because of that sort of conflict. That kind of conceptual mismatch, you know, between you and somebody else, or you and the situation. So, I'm telling you this story really just to illustrate the power of concepts. The power of concepts. How much they drive our life. How much we build up a view of the world, and you know, if we're lucky, And most of the time we're surrounded by other people who have similar kind of concepts, and the whole thing sort of works as it does here. But what's really important in Dharma practice, and what's a crucial aspect of insight practice, is to be able to distinguish between concepts and reality. What is, let's say, concepts and direct experience, because you can say concepts, well, they also have a certain reality to them. But concepts and direct experience. I notice in this month's Shabda, Tejan Andra has put a piece in about this, and I'm really pleased, because it's kind of crucial. It's the one of the basic building blocks of Buddhist wisdom. And in fact, when we recite the Heart Sutra, that's really what it's getting at. It's getting at the fact that if we come to direct experience, we don't find the Eightfold Path, we don't find the Four Noble Truths, we don't find a nose. But you say, well, but what's that? You know, something there, isn't it? No nose. My dog's got no nose. How does he smell? Terrible. Right, so what is this? Yeah. Well, there's an experience, but this experience, it doesn't know that it's a nose. That's a concept, that's an idea that I put onto whatever this is. Yeah. So all the time we're using concepts, and most of the time we're confusing concepts with experience. And the Heart Sutra and the whole perfection of wisdom is trying to help us to separate out the two. Concepts are incredibly useful, but we need to know that they're concepts, because we need to be able to touch into direct experience, which is what the Bhakya Sutra is getting at when it talks about in the seen, just the seen, in the heard, just the heard, and so on. So when we're practicing just sitting, when we're practicing that moving into just sitting via the different senses, where we're aiming to get to is, or a, let's say, a very helpful way to practice, is to be feeling our way into what is actual experience aside from our concepts. And most of the time, we're living in a conceptual world. We're living in a world of ideas and mental after-images. Sound is a good example of this. So very often we're sitting in meditation and there's some sound, and we hear it, or it is heard, it just happens. And then it's already gone. But we kind of call it back. You know, we kind of recreate it mentally. Want to know, what was that sound? And so you kind of replay it subtly, mentally. And then you label it. And then you maybe make up a story about it. Oh, who's that coughing? Is that... Oh, is that... Oh, was that Vajranath? So, yeah, so it's really... from that simple sound. Thank you. I'm paying him £5 a cough as an assistant. From that simple sound, we then recreate, we carry it on, and we build up a story about a Vajranatha who's coughing, da da da. Yeah? And so with just sitting, we're trying to come back just to what is our actual experience in the moment, being with that. And that's actually very simple. And if we really get to do this, then it makes the whole process of insight exploration much easier, because, well, there are different aspects to insight. You can explore impermanence, you can explore dukkha, you can explore non-self. And if we take non-self, say, that sense that we have of me somewhere at the centre of experience or behind the experience, having the experience, me, the meditator, is, in a sense, a concept which we've taken as real. We can find the five skandhas. Well, down to a certain level we can find the five skandhas. But out of that, we build a sense of me. It's a bit like, it's the same as when you get people talking about the order. Yeah. Oh, the order's like this, the order's like that. I was walking at Wyndham with somebody last summer who was on the order convention. He was saying, oh, the orders, da-da-da. And we were passing various order members, so I was kind of saying, oh, is Kamala Nandi like that? Is Ananta like that? And they were going, no, they're not like that. But, and then we, after a bit, we started to laugh, because it was kind of obvious that the order had parted company from order members. We had this sense of the order, which was different from the actual order members, the actual reality that you could find of the order. Now, similarly, in a way, the sense of me, me, this persistent person going through experience, is a concept which has parted company from the five skandhas. Yeah, it's like the Buddha can say, I shall spend the rainy season at Savatthi, but he's just aware that he's referring to these five skandhas, that all being well will be at Savatthi in the beginning of the rainy season. But very often when we talk about me, it's as if somehow there is someone who has the five skandhas, or sort of is in the middle of the five skandhas. We're not quite sure what the relationship is, actually. I mean, one of the ways in which we preserve a sense of me is that we keep it all rather vague. It sort of shifts around at different times. It's like my knee, say. You know, some of the time my knee is my possession, there's me and there's my knee. But then somebody bumps into me in the corridor and hits me down there, and I go, they bumped into me. Suddenly my knee is me. It's all quite confused when you start to explore it. Anyway, yes, we're fundamentally, we've confused concepts with actual experience. So one whole approach to insight is to come back to direct experience. And then in the case of this sense that we have of a real me, a real self, a real ego, We can just look and see what we actually find in experience. And that changes the whole picture. It changes the whole picture of spiritual life. Because up until that point, even though we sort of know it theoretically, we know about anatta, still there's some kind of a sense of a me that we have to, how do you put it, Dharmakirti? We have to give up self, or you're trying to give up self.
Let it go.
Let it go, yeah, yeah. Yeah. I remember years ago, a couple of order members, I think probably Kulamitra and Dhanavira and one or two other people, they went into a Chinese restaurant and the waiter came up and they started to order and they said they were vegetarian. So he was going through the menu saying, well, you could have this one and this one. And you could have this one with oyster sauce. And they said, no, sorry, you know, we're vegetarian. We don't eat oyster sauce, and, you know, it's not vegetarian. So the waiter said, oh, yes, it is. Now, I've had this trouble, you know, it's like living in Spain for a few years when I was at Gujiloca. You know, you go into a restaurant, and after a while I developed this whole kind of litany. You have to explain, you know, not being vegetarian didn't mean just not eating beef. It meant not eating chicken, fish, pork, lamb, and, oh, and tuna, you know, it's like, yes, tuna was there, tuna was, you know. So you just learn, you know, you have to kind of educate people. So they said to the waiter, no, look, you know, oysters, you know, they're not vegetarian. So, you know, oyster sauce isn't vegetarian. And the waiter said, oh, yes, it is. So, what do you think? Should they get up and walk out? You know, what's the matter with this guy? So they said, look, you know, oysters, they're living beings. We don't eat living beings, okay? So, oyster sauce isn't vegetarian. And the waiter said, oh, yes, it is. And it transpired that in this particular restaurant, they'd managed to make an oyster sauce which had no oysters in it. And suddenly, the whole situation was different. Now, similarly, when you're still in the state of believing that there is a self, you know, viscerally you kind of feel, you know, here I am, this is me, then inevitably somehow you're trying to let go of yourself as a Buddhist, do away with yourself, see through yourself. So there's that whole work to do. It's a bit like, you know, you have to get into the sauce and kind of pick out the bits of oyster that are in there, you know, that's the Buddhist project, and sort of chuck them out. Until you finally are left with something which has, you know, is completely innocent of oysters. Yeah? So you can do the same sort of thing with your Dharma practice, feeling like you've somehow got to kind of, you know, pick out all the bits of self and the ego and, you know, take them away until finally there's nothing there. But if there are no oysters in the oyster sauce, then it's just a question of relaxing in the first place and not worrying about the darn thing. And the same could be said of the ego and the self. Yeah. Yeah. At the moment, if we have a sense of me in here, then yeah, we compare ourselves with others. Am I going to be praised? Am I going to be blamed? Am I going to do well out of this? Am I going to do badly out of this? Am I going to be famous? Am I going to be ignored? Am I going to hurt? Am I going to feel good? Am I going to die after death? Am I going to carry on existing? Am I not going to exist? Ooh. But if there is no self in the first place, we can just drop all that. We can let the whole darn thing go. So suddenly we're in a very different world. And insight helps us get into that world. So through exploring our experience, we can come to this point where we're clear, yes, you know, there are times where it's useful to talk about I and me and mine, but we know that what the actual situation is on the ground. And that's what insight practice is getting us to. And it's where just sitting is helping us to get to as well. Because it's taking us in the direction of in the seen, just the seen, in the heard, just the heard, and so on. Right, I better stop and give us some time to meditate.